Good morning. We're going to call the Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee meeting to order. Can I have a motion from someone on the minutes from our last committee hearing on March 11th?
I will move the minutes of March 11th, Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott moves the minutes from March 11th. Any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of the minutes of March 11th, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are adopted. With that, we want to welcome Representative Neuberger to the Government Operations Committee. With that, I will go ahead and move your House File 722 to be referred to the Committee on Civil Law. With that, Mr. Gehring, if you would, just as we're starting to get balked up here on time, would you let us know what the jurisdiction of the committee is over this bill?
Mr. Chair and members, so this bill, I believe, is in the Government Operations Committee because it sort of generally affects local units of government through law enforcement agencies. And then on page 2 in paragraph D, there's some language related to public order and disaster emergency proclamations by the governor, which is sort of a function of government operations.
Excellent. With that, welcome Representative Neuberger to the committee. Go ahead and get going on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Representative Neuberger, and I'm here to discuss 722 and hopefully move it through this committee with your good graces. This is an emergency powers piece of legislation. Days after Hurricane Katrina, then the New Orleans Police Superintendent Eddie Compass issued an order to confiscate all firearms, including those from law-abiding citizens. Mm-hmm. No one, he said, no one will be able to be armed, end quote. He said that, quote, guns will be taken, only law enforcement will be allowed to have guns, end quote. Deputy Police Chief Warren Riley told the press, he said, quote, we're going to take all the weapons, end quote. Law enforcement and National Guard troops were sent door to door to take firearms from law-abiding hurricane survivors who were just trying to protect themselves from looters and thugs who ruled the streets. We also saw the same situation happen in 1992. Unfortunately, in Los Angeles, we had the riots there after the Rodney King trial, where we also had a similar situation. Hurricane Katrina and the LA riots showed us what can happen when emergencies, either natural or man-made, can strike. There are some things that we can count on at this time. One, we can count on a loss of cell phone service. Most of us use our cell phones as our primary means of communication. Here in Minneapolis, St. Paul area, we saw a catastrophic collapse of the cell phone system right after the bridge collapse. No one could get a cell phone call out. If that's all it took was a one bridge to collapse to wipe out our cell phone service here for emergency purposes, I hate to shudder to think what a natural disaster would do. We saw also in these situations in Katrina and in the LA riots a breakdown of law and order, a complete breakdown. Pretty much no 911 service. Actually, there was non-existent for many days. The police department and the fire departments and the EMS people. I don't want to cast any negative shadows on the folks that work the street, because I'm one of those people. They were simply overburdened and overwhelmed. There was too much emergency and not enough emergency workers. Individual citizens, were left to their own devices to protect themselves, their families, their children, and their property. The chaos and the civil disorder we witnessed in New Orleans after the abolished rights of law-abiding Americans to defend themselves with firearms against out-of-control criminals and gangs, this confirmed gun owners' worst fears that the government can confiscate our lawfully owned firearms here in America. When 911 is non-existent and law enforcement personnel are overwhelmed with search and rescue missions and other emergency duties, law-abiding Americans must have an effective means to protect their families. Emergency power bills prohibits states in local governments and that prohibits them from confiscating our legal firearms from law-abiding citizens during natural disasters or other calamities. A majority of states and the federal government have now passed such protective bills, and most have passed with overwhelming bipartisan support for people to be able to protect themselves. There are 32 states, I'm not going to list them off, but there are 32 states that have already done this. With that, Mr. Chair and members, I would like to present this bill to you, and I'm open for your questions.
Thank you, Representative Neuberger. I have one other testifier on the agenda. Heather Callio, is she interested in testifying or just here for support?
Mr. Chair, thank you for that question. Heather Callio, for full disclosure, is the NRA, National Rifle Association, lobbyist. She is available for testimony if I so require her or if anyone else does. She did send out an email to all of the members, or you should have received it. If not, I can provide it for you. The NRA and the GOCRA, the Gun Owner Civil Rights Alliance people, all endorse and support this bill.
Thank you, Representative Neuberger. Any member questions or discussion? Seeing none, anyone else in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Welcome to the committee, sir. If you would, state your name and who you represent.
Thank you very much. My name is David Gross. I'm an attorney in Faribault, Minnesota. I'm also the treasurer and a member of the board of directors of the Gun Owners Civil Rights Alliance. And I'll keep it really short. What happens in an emergency is that government wants to serve, and it when they get overwhelmed, they become short-sighted. And it was determined in New Orleans that what they had done in terms of seizing weapons was unconstitutional. But that was determined a couple of years after the fact. And what this bill does is it kind of says to government, look, when you're excited and you need to be calm, we're going to remind you of what your duty is. And so this enforces the Constitution. And it just gives a little guidance. It shouldn't be necessary, but when things are really overwhelming and exciting, that's when you need some kind of lodestone to work off of. And this bill, I think, will provide that for government to remember its place. That's all.
Thank you, Mr. Gross, for your testimony. Mm-hmm. Representative Nelson.
Stay there, Mr. Mr. Gross. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gross, I guess I'm a gun owner. I'm a hunter. I guess I don't have the fear of this, but how is this above and beyond what our U.S. Constitution and our says going to stop an overzealous or a fearful law enforcement person from thinking he can do this, more, like I said, more than the Constitution? Because I know we could pass the law and put it on the books, but not every law enforcement person knows every law that's on our books and knows how to interpret them and may, in a time of emergency, go out and do this. So how is this going to stop that from happening more so than our U.S. Constitution?
Mr. Gross.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson. I think you and I agree that it shouldn't have to be said, but it's just a reminder, and it's kind of on the books, and it'll bring it to the what we hope is that it'll bring it to the forefront of government's consciousness. All right, just a written reminder that you can't do it. For example, we have the Minnesota Citizens Personal Protection Act of 2003. When we passed it the first time and the second time, the United States Supreme Court hadn't hadn't decided that the Second Amendment was mandatory through the 14th Amendment Due Process Clause. We said so. We operated on it, even though later it was determined, according to the Second Amendment, that what we have as the Minnesota Citizens Personal Protection Act is the law, Constitution, still the law of the land. All right. So sometimes you do things in statutes to carry out, to further, to enforce the Constitution, not to create something new. And so we adopted the MCPPA, and I'm suggesting that we also adopt something like this, simply to say we recognize our constitutional obligation, and we're going to make it explicit, not a matter of interpretation and original thought on the part of somebody who may or may not be thinking clearly, but rather explicitly written down a directive that says, by the way, here's part of your job description, and this is a limitation on it.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, sir. If you drill into this a little deeper, just to give a little more clarity as well to Representative Nelson, during a state of declared emergency, our Second Amendment rights can be, in some instances, suspended. And what this does is it says that can't happen. They can be suspended through mutual aid agreements or commandeering orders. There's multiple sections within the emergency powers authority that the governor has that would give them the ability to circumvent our rights to protect ourselves during a declared emergency. So what this does is it says if there's a declared disaster or an emergency, that this ensures that we don't lose our rights to legally and lawfully defend ourselves or carry firearms. This is only for legally and lawfully abiding citizens.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I guess I don't see it, but that's differences of opinion are what makes life interesting. So,
thank you, Representative Nelson. Thank you, Mr. Gross, for your testimony. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Perhaps this is a question of counsel. The term state of emergency, is that defined in law? And I guess I'm also curious as to how many we've had, you know, in past history.
Do you have a place in the bill where those words appear?
It's line 1.7.
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, there is a procedure in statute for the governor to declare states of emergency, and there's a process that the governor has to follow to make that happen. I guess I don't have statistics immediately on how many emergencies have been issued, but I know that's a process that does happen on occasion.
Mm-hmm. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, not being a lawyer, I don't know if there needs to be any reference to that in that section. Just wondering, because then later on page 2.10, 2.10, talk about or disaster emergency proclamation. So I just don't know if the definition needs to be tighter. Just inquiring.
Thank you, Representative Runbeck. Any final member questions or comments? Representative Lane.
You just made me think that Representative Runbeck, that a state of emergency could be a disaster down in the southwest corner of the state, and now across the entire state this would apply. It's confusing to me.
Any other member questions or comments? Seeing none, Representative Neuberger will give you the last words.
No other words to say, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your time, and thank you, members.
With that, I will renew my motion that House File 722 be referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. House File 722 is re-referred to Civil Law. Thank you, Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, members. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is Representative Drazkowski in the room? There he is. Look at that. Good timing. Welcome, Representative Drazkowski, to the committee. I'll go ahead and move House File 922.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair and members, House File 922 is a bill designed to bring, as far as we could tell, with the help of our excellent House research staff upstairs, as many of the special election, local special election referenda and other special elections that we can, to move those to the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November, both on odd and even election years. So in the even election year, these referenda would be held with the general election as part of the general election, and in the odd year, it would simply be a special election in those jurisdictions that wouldn't otherwise have, say, a school board election or a city election going on. It would just simply be a special election on that first Tuesday after the first Monday in November. So these are the collection of provisions and statute, of sections of statute that we were able to find. We did keep a few of them out. The ones dealing with townships, we basically left alone and left where they were because, you know, townships do their annual meeting every year and really can accomplish a lot of that there. So this is the bill before you. In terms of the bill itself, and the reason we're bringing it is to do two things. One, allow higher levels of voter participation in these special elections. We see and have heard of many of these special elections where there's 10 or 15% voter turnout in jurisdictions, whether you're talking about school elections or county elections or city elections or some of the special district taxing district elections as well. You're seeing situations where the voter turnout in these is very low. As we know, in our general election, Minnesota leads the nation, gets upwards of 80% or more turnout, and so that's what we are hoping and striving for in this, that we can have more people participate in these elections and ensure that that happens by the way that the legislature structures them. And then secondly, provide for cost savings for our local jurisdictions. And one of the things that I and I know other members have been working on is figuring out how we reduce mandates for local jurisdictions. And when we have special elections written into law that happen at obscure times of the year, what we end up with is a mandate on them to put together a special election to pay the costs of that special election. Ostensibly, members, this bill would reduce that cost from whatever it normally would be to zero in those even-yeared elections that happen to happen during a general election, because the cost of that election then would be zero in a general year versus whatever it would be that the local jurisdiction otherwise would experience. So that's the bill, members, and those are the two arguments for it. And Mr. Chair, I have one testifier in favor of the bill with me, a constituent. If he could talk a bit too, that would be excellent.
Thank you, Representative Drazkowski. Sir, welcome to the committee. If you would introduce yourself for the record and let us know who you represent.
Thank you, Chair and Representatives. My name's Keith Knutson. I'm a dairy farmer down in Pine Island, Minnesota. I appreciate the straightforward and common sense approach to a very critical component of our democracy, the fair and honest expression of our thoughts and wishes through the voting process. In this great country, it has been established and supported with legislation that the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November is the day all Americans have the opportunity to vote. The current system in Minnesota, in my opinion, has a number of shortcomings that this legislation fixes. It provides for continuity. We know when and where, which is very important in the rural areas, that the election process will be held. It also provides support for the actual day, people operating the polling stations. As in my township, the rural supervisors, they have to make sure that they're there for the polling. They all know that when they sign on and take on the responsibility of being a supervisor, that they will be in attendance the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November. This provides also for maximum turnout potential. Our society operates under the premise of majority rule. In the truest sense of that, no legislation should be allowed to pass unless the proper percentages are attained with 100% of eligible voters casting their ballot. But since this is unrealistic, the next closest set of conditions should be utilized, and that is what this legislation accomplishes. Picking and choosing dates, times, and various polling places are all done to change the voter subset. We recently had a building proposal in the Pine Island School District. On the voting day, I had neighbors saying, "What do you mean there's voting going on today?" We also had going on in the school itself, any adult, 18-year-old students were encouraged and allowed to leave the school during school days classes so that they could go and attend and vote. Employers are not allowed or are not forced to allow employees to take time off from work on that day. And the polling place was not the typical polling place for residents. We need legislation for fair and level playing field. A great idea will always be a great idea, and waiting until November will prove that out. I strongly urge your support of House File 922. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Knutson, for your testimony. We appreciate it. Representative Mullery, you're first on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions, and I was reading through and I couldn't pick it up real quick. Does this affect any elections of people or just spending?
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Mullery. I don't think it does affect any of those, but I see Ms. Dyson and Mr. Gehring looking through the provisions we put together, and I would defer to them at this point.
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, all the provisions in the bill affect ballot question elections, and so they're not special elections for candidates for office.
Okay.
The ballot questions.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My second question is, what happens in years when there are not general elections? In other words, school boards or somebody else may need to get some money and not want to wait 2 years. Is that affected by this?
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Mullery, and Ms. Dyson can maybe point us, or Mr. Gehring, the point in the bill, but as I remember when we drafted this, we basically in the odd years required the special election, if there was one, to be called on the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November. So it would be on that same date that a general election would be if it was an even year, but it would simply be held on that same date. So people are conditioned to look to November 4th, 5th, 6th, or whatever date that is. And the idea is that if there's an election, it's happening on that day.
Representative Mullery. Thank you. Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick clarifying question for Mr. Gehring again. In Section 2, it includes, or Section 1, it talks about capital project levy referendum. I know we occasionally do capital improvement bonds at the city level. Would it affect those?
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe the answer is yes.
Representative Joachim.
So it would affect a capital improvement bond. We did one on our main street so that we could lighten the burden on the business owners so they wouldn't have to pay an extra assessment cost. And if you had to wait for November to let the bond, you kind of screw up your construction season. So that's a little bit of a concern for me. I don't know. Representative Nash isn't in here. Or Representative O'Driscoll, did your city use capital? We don't use them very often at all. We've only used them twice in the 9 years I can think of. But
Representative O'Driscoll?
Is Representative Yukim asking me to yield to a question, or is she just
yes.
stating an
yes,
inquiry?
Yes, I'm sorry. I'm
yes.
sorry.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Joachim, we have in the city of Sartell not used those types of things probably since the 1970s when we built Fire Hall, City Hall, some of those kinds of things.
Okay. Representative Joachim.
Thank you. So that would be my concern is with the few times the city does need that tool, and in our case we did it so that we'd lessen the burden on the Main Street businesses. It would have screwed up the construction cycle for us to get the bids out, or the RFPs out, and get the bids back to start in the spring. So,
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Joachim. So if I could, I think the idea here is that we do move it to that first Tuesday after the first Monday in November. And originally, I was just going to say, you know what, hold it on the general election regardless. And that was really too inflexible. So the idea here is first Tuesday after the first Monday, regardless if it's an even year or an odd year, it lands there. When it's in an even year, it lands in the general election, so we have those savings associated with being part of the general election ballot. We don't need additional staff there to do the ballot things they do, and the costs associated with them. In terms of the local unit of government, you could argue that if they got to November 15th or something and suddenly decided they needed to, build a building, you could argue that they have to go an entire year for that. Knowing these processes, though, and maybe Ms. Dyson could elaborate more if you're interested, but these are oftentimes multi-month and multi-year processes, the capital improvement project planning process with the jurisdiction, and I think with this being in law, they'd be able to easily anticipate and understand when that is and where it fits into the calendar. So I wouldn't suspect there'd be a lot of problems.
Representative Joachim.
Chair, Representative Driscoll, I totally agree with you with the planning. I'm talking more about the construction cycle and how it's affected and getting the bids out and back, but maybe, I don't know if there's anybody here from the counties or the cities. I was trying to get the information late last night from my city manager to try to figure it out, and he was still unclear too, so I didn't know if anybody else was here to that could maybe clarify. Maybe I'm thinking of the wrong thing too.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Joachim, I think they would have to pass the referendum first, and this really only affects the referendum, and once that's passed, then they go into the bid letting process, and so I suspect that won't have any impingement at all on that process.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the concern, well, with the construction process, if they held their, the city held it early in the spring, they could get the bids out, and so they could gain in a construction season, and if it passed, and so they could start this summer instead of waiting for next summer, which could increase the cost. But the question I had, and my mind just kind of went blank here when. But anyway, Mr. Chair, let me think about it. I'll come back.
Sure, absolutely, Representative Nelson. We'll come back to you.
I was thinking about it.
Yeah. We'll come back to you when you're ready. With that, I don't have any other members on the list. And I don't. Representative Nelson, that's all it takes.
I just looked at my note here.
Sometimes that's all it takes.
Was where? Mr. Knutson stated that then you know where the elections are being held as far as school board elections and general elections. And in my district, in my part of the world, and maybe it's different in your part of the world, school board elections are held in a different polling place. I have a polling place for school board elections different from my polling place for general elections. And maybe that's different in the rural areas. There's only one place that they go vote. But I know when we've had school board elections on issues, I have a different polling place than I normally go to. And there's... Would this affect that at all? Would they have to have them in the same polling place? And I just want to make sure that that's out there, that it's not always in the same polling place.
Mr. Knutson or Representative Driscoll?
I think maybe Mr. Knutson can respond.
Mr. Knutson.
Representative Chair and Representative Nelson, thank you for the question. In my area, in Pine Island, our general elections are, for the rural people, go to the township hall during the normal election cycle, and that first Tuesday after the first Monday, that's where it's always held. And when you go there, they'll ask you, what school district do you live in? You know, they can look it up, but they pretty much know where we live, and then all our school district's activities that are voted on that year are taken care of in that place. When we've had special elections or special voting processes, I've had to either vote in the cafeteria of the local school, or I voted at the local church in the city of Pine Island for that. Points of, you know, I figured it out. Most people can. But this bill would make it so that we know where we're going for all voting. And it's to that one spot. For your situation where you would, the school district, I think it would be easier to combine it like what ours does, where you would have one polling place. You wouldn't have to drive from this end of town to that end of town to do voting at two different places. To me, it's simpler to just go to one place, take care of all your voting, and that's it. Because you know that's the day, and that's when you vote.
And it does not appear in this bill that the any language in here actually changes the polling place, just the date, from what I can read. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, or Mr. Chair. Confused this morning, anyway.
I'll take chair today.
I know in my part of the world, and I live in the suburban area, when they redistricted last time, they purposely divided one of my precincts that used to be one combined precinct in half, because part of it was in one school district and part of it was another, because in a prior election they had confusion where people came to vote and people that lived in the one school district were ended up voting on the other school district's issues. And so now they've got them divided and they got two separate polling places. But even in the past, like during school district elections, again, we have a different polling place than that because the school district sets their elections up separately. So that's just a question I had.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chair, I had a comment, but is there another witness coming, or is this the end of...
I don't have any on the agenda, but I'm assuming that there are probably a couple of folks in the audience that wish to testify.
I'll wait till...
Okay, perfect. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just some scoping questions on the bill for the author, if I could. This, as I read the preliminaries on this, Representative Drazkowski, it identifies cities and school districts and some other hospitals and different things. Were you planning on including counties and or townships in the scoping on this? Because I noticed that they're not listed, and they also have those levying authorities.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative O'Driscoll, the intention was, and we may have actually have some that affect counties. As I understand, we don't have any that affect townships, though, and we contemplated that when I wrote the bill, and we left them out because they are so local and responsive, and they have their annual meeting each year that can accommodate a lot of that. But I'm wondering if Mr. Gehring could tell us if there's any relating to counties in here. There wasn't any intent to leave counties out, but we want, and we're not even sure if we got all of the sections of statute that fit into this area, but we think we got most or maybe all of them. And I think there were one or two that we did leave out just because, and I can't remember, maybe Ms. Dyson, we put the bill together quite a while ago. Anyway, I hope that's helpful.
Ms. Dyson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Driscoll, I think it's the counties are covered by the general provision in Section 26. That's the chapter, it's amending 475.59. And that the term used in Chapter 475 is municipality, but the definition of a municipality in that chapter, just a second, means a city of any class, county, town, or school district. So that section that provides that referenda for issuing bonds of a municipality, and then on page 18, the election date provides that it's either the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November of either an even-numbered or odd-numbered year, so that would affect all the municipalities except towns.
Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Drazkowski, to the odd even first Tuesday after the first Monday, if a community covered by this legislation does not have a regularly scheduled election on an odd numbered year, would they or would they not be prohibited from having a special election on that odd numbered first Tuesday after the first Monday?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative O'Driscoll, the way the bill is written, they would have their special election on that first Tuesday after the first Monday in November of that odd-numbered year, and have it just the same way they would if it was on April 15th or April 13th or whatever, the way the law reads now. And so the intention is simply to move it to that November date, to provide no other... we don't want to provide any additional mandate on local units of government, simply change the date and specify the date upon which those special elections should be held.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Drazkowski, for that clarification. So a community would, or a government entity would, have at least one shot per year, whether they had regularly scheduled, even, or odd-numbered elections.
Representative.
Mr. Chair,
continue.
One other thing that as I'm kind of looking down the pike here based on past legislation that's passed, we've now implemented all-day kindergarten, which is going to put demands on our schools and facilities, and there's the governor's contemplation of all four-year-olds, full-day option, pre-K types of things. That may put pressures on our school districts. I'm hoping that we might hear from some representatives from schools as to what they're experiencing for pressure right now and how this law may or may not affect their ability to meet the state-required mandates, and if they would end up having to go out and incur lease payments and incur other kinds of things that may otherwise hamper budgets that they could have gone to the voters for. Just looking again for good public policy, as many know, and Representative Drazkowski has sat on this committee in the past with me, knowing that that's all I ever try to find is good public policy. So I'm just kind of looking down the pike so we don't have any other potential problems.
Thank you for the segue, Representative O'Driscoll. I see Ms. Kelleher has been waiting patiently in the wings, so if you can come on down, welcome to the committee. Just introduce yourself for the record and let us know who you represent, and go ahead with your comments.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. Our association covers every school district in the state of Minnesota. We're here today with concerns about this bill, and I want to start off by saying not all local governments were created the same. School districts are very unique in the fact that, unlike cities, counties, and townships, we have no authority to raise levies on our own, or I would say minimal authority. Over the years, there has been ongoing sort of underfunding of K-12 education, and what has happened is a lot of districts have gone to their public and asked them to support the schools. So that has indeed happened. I went back and tried to look at the numbers and find out if there was more passage or failure rates in the off-election year or election year, and what I found is they're about the same. It depends on the school district. I can guarantee you if you push us to one day, A, you're going to have a ballot that's immense. B, you're going to have school district facility costs go through the roof. We had a large facility plan brought forward to the legislature this year, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of interest, but what it does show is we've got buildings in need of work, and oftentimes with the voters, okay, we can go forward and do that. Those are not items we can levy for. The other thing to think about is we are very limited by the legislature. Pensions, for instance, since we've got the chair in the room, is not something school districts can levy for. They come out of our general ed accounts. So we are, in fact, greatly different from the other local governments. The other way we're different is we have school districts in statutory operating debt. They are very, are required by law to do a lot of things, and you can find it in 123B8(3)(3). And there, if your negative unreserved general fund balance is 2.5% in the hole. You must present the commissioner with a plan, how you intend to get out of it, and go to your voters to help you with this. And you're allowed by law to go to the voters three times during those years. We average about 11 of these a year. Presently, we have Brooklyn Center, Franconia, Ivanhoe, Swan, Bill Kimball, Clearbrook, Gagnac, and Glenville Emmons, who are in that situation presently. So this would be a great deal of hardship going forward, and some of those issues could compound over time. So with that, members, I'll be happy to stand for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Kelleher. Representative Mallory, did you have a question to this testifier?
Mr. Chair, it looks like another person's moving down, so I'll just wait until all the testifiers.
Sounds good. Welcome to the committee, sir. If you would, just introduce yourself, let us know who you represent, and then proceed.
Excuse me. Mr. Chair, members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. We represent 835 of the state's cities across the state. Excuse me. I'm here today to just share some concerns. We don't have specific positions on House File 922. Our policy committees did not adopt anything specific to this, but I would like to share some observations that have been shared with me from some of our cities. First of all, many of these provisions that are being amended have been in law for quite a long time, and I think they were enacted to allow some flexibility when we were required to go to the voters for voter approval of various levies for capital or operating purposes. And I didn't do a whole legislative history, but I think some of these provisions have been in law for in excess of 20 years. I think we've already discussed, or the committee already discussed, the fact that the requirement to hold these elections on the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November could create some problems with certain bond issues that are done for certain construction projects, essentially requiring that those be bumped into a whole nother construction cycle down the road. If the trigger of a referenda by the voters in a reverse referenda process, as occurs in about five of the sections of this bill, were to occur late in the year, the voter approval might not occur until the following November, and then the construction project might not be undertaken until the following construction season. So that could create a wrinkle when you have a project that needs to be done rather promptly. There may be situations where a city is required to issue some emergency debt or some debt that may require voter approval or may trigger a reverse referenda requirement. And if that emergency, be it an infrastructure problem, occurs late again in the year, it could actually delay the city's ability to respond to the broken water main, the bridge problem, or whatever it might be. So we want to be very careful not to have unintended consequences about the ability of a city to respond to an infrastructure challenge. And then finally, I'd like to just mention a couple of other things that I've shared with Representative Dreskowski and staff. Minnesota Statutes 205-105 allows that a general election can be postponed in the event of inclement weather or weather problems. And given the reference in this bill to the specific date of the first Tuesday after the first Monday, if there were a delay in a general election as a result of 205-105, I believe, and staff can correct me if I'm wrong, we could have a problem that the general election wouldn't be held in the event of inclement weather. So we might want to look at that more carefully and decide whether we need to fix the bill with that respect. And I guess just finally I'll say we'll continue to work with the author. Representative Dreskowski has been very gracious in talking with me about this bill, and we'll continue to work with him to address any other issues that we identify.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Representative O'Driscoll.
Just a quick question for Mr. Carlson, if I could. Mr. Carlson, many communities come to the legislature asking for a local option sales tax. Do you see the authorization to go back to their voters to have that conversation and then put that on a referendum? Do you have any concerns with this bill and the ability for communities to be able to do that under this legislation, where some of those might be continuations if voters approve, where there could be a potential gap, so that businesses would incur the cost and there would be the expense of taking out the local option sales tax only to have it go to the voters and then go back and have businesses once again incur that cost of tracking and educating people on that? Just curious to see, since that's something that the legislature gets at least annually three or four inquiries from communities on, and that goes through our tax division and things. And Representative Dreskowski may actually have some of those in his committee that they're asking about it. So I guess I would invite him to share thoughts on it too. And I think about the fact that he's the local property chair.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, and I wish Pat Dalton was here, because she usually drafts a lot of those bills that deal with the local sales taxes, either the origination of those taxes or the extensions of those taxes. If I'm not mistaken, and maybe Ms. Dyson or Mr. Gary knows, I think frequently those require a general election approval, but I see Ms. Dyson nodding her head, but I'm not entirely sure of that. There may be situations where the legislature decides to override that general election requirement and allow a special election to occur. So I'd have to do a little bit more research for you. There are several bills that will be coming up this year. I think we're going to have a hearing next Wednesday morning in Representative Dreskowski's committee on a couple of those local sales tax bills, Wyndham, Walker. I think there's a few extension bills as well. I will review those and get back to you specifically about whether this requirement would impact those sales taxes.
Mr. Chair. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you. Just one comment. Representative Draskowski, I do support the efforts of what you're looking at on this, but I also want to make sure that we don't have any orphans out there, and then we've got the whole public policy realm, and that's why I asked the question about the local option sales tax, because it's not specific to a referendum for property taxes, but it is a local referendum where you are going to be levying a sales tax. And as I looked through the bill, I did see a specific differentiation between the two. And so I just want to make sure that we know what our legislative intent is. Thank you.
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for Representative Driscoll. And Mr. Carlson and I will have our eyes out for that. And as we go through local option sales tax week next week in our committee, we'll be drawn into those and certainly look. I don't remember, and I don't think there's anything, any of these provisions that specifically address that. And I see Ms. Dyson trying to dig to get the answers, but we will work to address it so that it works in the same way as we go forward.
Why don't we go ahead on to our next testifier?
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Inter-County Association that consists of 10 of the regional center counties in greater Minnesota and 4 of the ring counties here in the metropolitan area. And I do want to express my concern about this bill as well. I think it creates both practical issues as well as issues with existing statutes. As has already been alluded to, if a local government wants to issue bonds to finance projects during a coming construction season, this bill would frustrate coming up with those monies. I particularly want to highlight the problem that would occur for those local governments, communities that were the victims of natural disasters. Frequently, because of the significant problems that's created with their infrastructure, they need to come up with the funds to quickly repair those and get them back into operation. And issuing bonds is frequently a means by which they want to come up with those revenues. And under this bill, there's no provision to provide an exception to the November general election for that. I also want to highlight a issue that exists with the existing deadlines for the truth in taxation or preliminary tax notice that's all currently required to go out in November of every year. And the problems that this creates with giving the disclosure that you want to local taxpayers has to the property taxes that they can anticipate for the coming year. Under sections 7 and 8, which are not currently operative but may become operative under legislation either that Representative Draskowski has introduced or may be contemplating, these elections would either authorize bonds or an exception to the currently codified but not operative currently levy limits. And right now, if levy limits were to be imposed on cities and counties, they have the opportunity to ask their electors to provide an exception to those limits at either a special or general election. If we're precluded from doing that request at a special election, then we would not have the information timely enough to include that levy were it to be authorized on the truth in taxation notice. So taxpayers would not be necessarily cognizant of the full impact of the taxes planned by their cities, counties, and school districts under this legislation were they to be only to authorize those exceptions at the November general election. Same is true under Section 26, which affects basically most of the bonds issued by cities and counties. Again, we can get authorization at special elections, and it's particularly appropriate if you don't have this construction season issue to do it at this August primary election. Again, if we get authorization at the August primary election, it doesn't cost us any more money, but yet we would have that information in time to be reflected on the truth and taxation notice were to be passed. If under this bill we would have to wait till the November election, the additional levy for the debt service on those bonds would not be included in the truth and taxation notice, and consequently the disclosure that you want to taxpayers through that device won't occur. With that, I'll conclude. Be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Mulry, I think that ends our testifiers. Do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's more of a comment. After hearing all of the testimony and thinking about it, Representative Draskowski, I think there's a need for something like this in a much more narrow way. I'm thinking offhand of a real thing that we do need to get at, which this would get at, and that was brought up by the school districts. And one of the ones that was mentioned as in trouble, it's not my district, but I know of it and know a lot about it, and we all knew that it was going to be in trouble. They kept trying over and over and over and over to pass, and a new huge bonding for a lot of construction, and they kept failing and failing and failing and failing until finally one time there was a low turnout and it passed, and immediately they're in trouble. It's a district that in some ways I like it because they're doing a lot of innovative things in their schools, but which are outstanding, but they really got in a mess, and everybody knew that it should never have been done. So I understand you really want to get at that type of problem, but I think you're going way too far on this one. I think it needs a lot of work to narrow down and cut out a lot of the things that it could cause problems with. That's my view of it.
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mulry, this is these issues brought up by the schools and the counties are not major issues that we can't deal with as we move this bill forward. As a matter of fact, this is really the first, I think, that many of these folks have had a chance to really dig into the nuts and bolts of this. As a matter of fact, I was deliberate about not putting provisions in this bill relating to or limiting the local government's ability to address those exceptional debt situations. And so those got left alone in this bill. We didn't do anything in terms of those. And so if there are concerns with statutory operating debt, and certainly the concerns that Mr. Carlson had, I'm very certain that we will be able to figure something out between here and the tax committee on those as we talk about the local government finance provisions of this. So we are going to be talking about the truth in taxation notices, so that this will dovetail quite nicely into that as we work this bill through.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it sounds like this is truly a work in progress, and so the author may not be able to answer my question, but I'm wondering if you've requested any kind of a local impact statement, hearing from local governments. It sounds like there could potentially be some economic repercussions for our local governments, and I want to be sure that they're protected. So wondering if you've done any analysis in that direction.
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Halverson, I have not. I know there's a process for that. I think we got to ask Ways and Means Chair or Tax Chair or somebody in order to do that. I'm certainly willing to ask those questions and ask for that or request it, but I haven't done it yet.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, and thank you, Representative Ruskowski. I think that would, I would certainly appreciate having that analysis.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Draskowski, I was wondering if you could maybe also when you're talking with the cities, look at, I was a little concerned about Section 19, and I finally figured out how it would have affected my city, and it's so rare that a reverse referendum is triggered if the city's done due diligence and done good planning and has a good project, and that was the project we had on our Main Street. We ended up finding some funds we had to match, and then we didn't want to assess our city businesses anymore, so we decided to do a capital bond levy, which is then subject to a reverse referendum if it's triggered. So we had started the project along with some of the money, needed more, planned the levy, waited to make sure that people didn't do the reverse referendum, but if they would have, we would have had to halt, then we would have lost the matching dollars and lost the project to redo our Main Street, which hadn't been touched in like 20 years. So just, I would like you to consider like unique examples. I know it's hard to craft a law around unique examples, but maybe talk to the cities about how building projects would be affected by that reverse referendum being triggered and having to wait.
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Joachim. Certainly that'll be part of our discussion and very willing to talk about it.
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and Representative Druskowski for bringing forth this bill. But I also just want to echo, as a former school board member, you know, my concerns around construction and having to delay projects and costing the taxpayers more money, in addition to the other logistical things that might come up. That, you know, that's a very real thing and something that it really needs to be addressed in your bill.
Thank you.
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Seltzer.
And Representative Druskowski will give you the final words on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. I think a good analysis and good questions around this bill, and I appreciate the folks from the school boards and cities and counties weighing in on this. As I mentioned, this has really been really the first maybe analysis from those groups about this proposal, and again, I'm confident that we can address the concerns that were raised, and I've got very good working relationships with each of those folks. So I think we'll do good stuff with this bill as we go forward. Appreciate your support.
Excellent. Thank you, Representative Druskowski. With that, I will renew my motion. The House File 922 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. House File 922 is re-referred to State Government Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you,
Representative Druskowski. Next on the agenda is House File 1365, Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Do you want me to move House File? Okay, I'm going to move House File 1365 to be referred to the General Registry.
Thank you, Representative Fenton. House File 1365 has been moved to the General Register. Representative Fenton, to your bill.
Thank you so much. First of all, I just want to say once again, it's great to be here with Secretary Simon. Actually, this is the very bill that we first met each other and started working together over. So it's great to be here regarding this. This bill is the June primary bill, and if you've been here before, then you've likely seen this before. This sets the state primary for the first Tuesday after the third Monday in June. And this bill also moves back the other dates in statute associated with preparing for a primary. Just a little bit of background. As you know, Minnesota's had extremely low primary turnout in the last few years, and you kind of hear that number. 2012 was just over 9% of eligible voters, and 2014 was just over 10%. As of 2014, there are 31 states that have a primary before June 30th. So one of the reasons that we did have to move the primary was so that our military voters had adequate time in advance of the election to get and return their ballots. But I just passed another bill including National Guard voter. One thing that June primary will actually help is make sure, because we hear from some of our military voters as well, that they're not always getting their ballots or getting them in time and getting them back. That's one advantage. We're one of the last in the nation. Moving us to the third Tuesday in June would also help us align more with the national primary calendar. Also, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Iowa. This would devote more time to the general election race, allowing voters more time to hear the differences of opinions and ideas between the candidates that will be on the general election ballot. And also, it would catch more people at home rather than on summer vacation. More people are likely to be here. And as a school teacher, you know, many of our polling locations are in our schools. And this helps. Moving the primary to June also helps some logistics with schools. The lights are still on. But if you've been in a school putting up your classroom or doing something in August, you know, oftentimes they're rebuffing the floors or there's some renovation projects and other things going on. So with that, this also has great bipartisan support. And with that, I would like to turn it over to our Secretary of State.
Thank you, Representative Fenton. Mr. Secretary, welcome again to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. Thanks, members. It's an honor to be with you. It's an honor to be with Representative Fenton. I thank her for her leadership as well. This is an issue that I've personally been involved with for quite some time. I was involved, I think, with you, Mr. Chair, and others in 2009, originally changing the date from September to August. And that was the result of a similar sort of bipartisan compromise at the time with Governor Pawlenty and others. And the rationale there was primarily, but not only, to make it easier for our overseas military to vote in the general election. But not just military. Other overseas Minnesotans, be they diplomats or missionaries or business people or students, and it has had some success in that area. After three statewide primary elections, 2010, 2012, and 2014, I think we can draw certain conclusions. One is that things have gotten easier for overseas Minnesotans, military and others. But I think they could be even better. And as Representative Fenton alluded to, we still hear some stories about military voters who don't get their ballots in time to send them back in time for the general election or for them to count. And that is, I think, unacceptable. But more broadly, we have the glaring problem of turnout that Representative Fenton and others have alluded to. I guess the question that always arises is, what if we held an election and no one showed up? We came somewhat close to that in 2014, despite the fact that we had exciting contests on both sides of the aisle. On the Republican Party, there was an exciting and close gubernatorial primary, and on the DFL side, there was an exciting, though somewhat unexpected, primary for state auditor. Despite the drama and excitement on both sides, turnout was still at 10%. So that tells me, coupled with the fact that we know Minnesotans normally, when given the opportunity at a time that's convenient, vote in very high numbers, we're routinely first, second, or third, or at the top of the list in general election turnout. We know that Minnesotans are joiners and doers and voters. That there's something off here about the August primary. How can an electorate that normally votes in such high numbers vote in such abysmally low numbers in a primary? And I think it's just that Minnesotans are being Minnesotans. It's August. They're doing what Minnesotans in August do. They're squeezing every last drop out of summer. They're out on the lake. They're out with family. They're on vacation. And that's probably why. So then the question is, what do we do about it? Well, July, you'd probably have much the same problem. June is a reasonable compromise. And as Representative Fenton alluded to, it would still not put us at an early date. By my count, just before I came over here, I looked at the most recent date of primaries. If we went in the second week of June, which this bill isn't, it's the third week, but if we went to the second week in June, we would be 28th in terms of the date of our primary. Some start in February and March. If we go to the third week in June, which this bill is, it puts us somewhere in the low 30s. So still in the second half, the bottom half of states in terms of earliness. So this isn't an early primary. It's earlier for Minnesota, but it would be early. And I think there's another issue beyond turnout, and at least this one that's motivated me, is I think it serves the voters best for us to be spending a larger proportion of the campaign season talking about who the best office holder would be, as opposed to who the best Democrat would be or who the best Republican would be. I don't think this prolongs or elongates the campaign season any. I think any candidate, particularly for statewide office, is always going to get started by the summer of the prior year. I don't think that's going to change. I don't think people will suddenly file for office or begin campaign activity any earlier. But right now we're spending at least two-thirds, probably three-fourths of the time in the life cycle of a campaign, arguing over who the best Democratic auditor, let's say, is, or Republican auditor candidate is, as opposed to just who's the best auditor in a general election. Who should be the next, I'm picking on that one office. But I think that's where the kind of the good government aspect of all this comes in. I would say one thing, and you may hear from this them today, Mr. Chair and members. I know there are some concerns from counties about particularly smaller and more rural counties about staffing needs, since county auditors and auditor treasurers typically wear many hats, particularly in greater Minnesota, and they handle property taxes, and the property tax season would also come at the time they'd be gearing up for a June primary. To that, I would say I would recommend, and I don't think it's going to happen today, but my respectful recommendation would be that the House as a whole and the legislature as a whole would consider a 2018 effective date rather than 2016 to give counties the time to plan for any staffing changes or needs that they would need to implement. That would be my recommendation, because I'm very sensitive, given the partnership between our office and the counties, that they be in a comfortable place when it comes to administering these new laws. One other thing, Mr. Chair, if I could, is, you know, having carried this bill in the past when I was among you in the legislature, I know that there are some members who are concerned, and I understand that in a hearing like this, it might not be the place to voice it, but they're privately voiced concerns about whether this endangers sitting office holders, and particularly sitting legislators. And the theory goes something like this. No one says these exact words, so I'm generalizing, of course, but there is a fear, perhaps, among some legislators that while they're stuck in St. Paul until the third week in May, some whippersnapper is going to go and primary them. And that they will be kind of powerless to defend themselves. To that, I have a couple responses. First is that it seems to me legislators are more often in the news in their communities when they're in the legislative session, particularly in greater Minnesota, where they get daily newspaper or radio or TV coverage. But secondly, look to a neighboring state, Iowa, which has a January through May legislative session, just like we do in Minnesota. And they also have a June primary. Now, we think of Iowa as the Iowa caucus state. That's for presidential purposes. But for purposes of choosing who the Republican or Democratic nominee is going to be for various offices, theirs is in June. And I looked at the election returns, and I don't have anything definitive for you here, but we can get that for you. And it is very rare that a sitting legislator has a meaningful primary challenge. Very rare. I can't see any evidence that having a June primary on the heels of their January to May legislative session has meant an increase somehow in primary activity. Very, very rare. It's usually the nuisance candidate that many members here have probably experienced from time to time that gets 5 or 7% of the vote and doesn't really make the member particularly break a sweat. So I think that this would still put us in the middle, really the bottom middle of the pack in terms of dates, and I think it will help Minnesota be as good as we know Minnesota can be when it comes to turnout and voting and participation. So with that, members, thank you. I'm happy to stand for questions. Otherwise, I'll leave and allow other testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary, for your testimony. I have two members on the list right now. Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fenton and Secretary Simon. Ooh, looks like I got the microphone today. Thanks for carrying this bill. I think that as somebody who was in 2014, there were days that I felt that I would almost have to light myself on fire to get voters' attention and get them to the polls, and why that would have been at least good for one time. But I think that when we looked at the turnout, I agree, Secretary, it was disappointing, because as Minnesotans, we expect much better. And I think that we catch people on vacation, or we find them maybe up at the cabin for that last weekend before school starts, or any number of other things. And I think that this date allows a couple of things. It increases participation on both sides, because both parties go on vacation. And what it will wind up doing is it's going to drive that voter, that conscientious voter that we have in the state of Minnesota, to come to the polls and do what many of them hold as a kind of a sacred duty, but, you know, maybe sacred after vacation. So I just think that by changing the date to the June date, I think it provides for greater participation, greater turnout, and it shows people that, you know, really we're kind of watching what happens, and we're trying to make it easier for them to come out and vote. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Secretary Simon, I have a couple concerns about this, and one is, you know, part of it is the us having to file during the during while we're still in the legislature. It's not so much worried about the idea of having to worry about some young whippersnapper, but more about what happens to us here in the legislature. Because once we file for office, or say a member decides not to file for office and not to run, now just the effect that's going to have on various legislative bills going forward, just the decorum among us in the legislature, and I have more concern about that than worried about somebody filing and running against me and knocking me out of primary. If that happens, so be it. That's something I've always run with the philosophy that possibly the worst thing that could happen to any of us is we do win our election and going forward, and I've always run on that kind of an attitude. But the other concern I have is more so the logistics of it. I mean, this year we're moving our precinct caucuses back to March to comply with the federal election cycle. And so now we're taking our precinct caucuses are in March, and we're moving the primary up to June. So that basically leaves March, April, and May to, and this is more so for the outstate area or districts, is that you're compressing the time when county conventions can be held. And again, this is more in the outstate where they have multiple counties that you're representing. I just have half of a city, and so it's not as a big of a deal in my district, but multiple county convention you have to go to, be at, the logistics of squeezing all these things into limited spaces that are available in some places to do this. And so the logistics part of it is we're compressing that time down, that the ability for those people to be able to get all that stuff done. Have a state convention, which would probably have to be in May, again, possibly while we're still in the legislature, for the two parties to get the endorsed candidates out there. And I guess that's the concern I have, is just compressing all that down to a shorter time frame. It makes it more difficult, I think, to get stuff through there. And that combined with, like I said, what it's going to do to us while we're in the legislative process, it's the concerns I have about this bill. And I and Secretary Simon and I have had these discussions before, and I have to admit I'm on the opposite side of this. I wish there were ways that we could go back to the September primary. I understand the military and the overseas voting portion of it with the HAVA legislation that kind of forced us to go to move the primary up. But these are my concerns, and I think that's going forward. That would be my concerns.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative Fenton, for bringing this bill, and for Secretary of State Simon as well. Both of you offered just really great testimony and heightened our awareness about all of the things, really, you know, the advantage, all of the advantages or the possible things. I have shared, I've come around on this issue in a big way, and I have shared the angst of a number of things that Representative Nelson brought up, and you know, this would be a big change for so many, and I think many are still really struggling with what does this look like, and I don't think we have the answers right now, but you know, I've already begun the process of what would this look like, and it just means doing things differently, and we're all challenged to consider change and what that looks like all the time. So you know, and I too did have a primary in 2012, and it was so disappointing to me, given how hard, you know, how we worked, you know, just the number of, you know, voters that we spoke with, and I think the overall turnout statewide was, if I'm not mistaken, 9%. And I remember being so disappointed to have only achieved 15%, which was a significant change from the statewide, but it was so disheartening for the efforts. I just didn't feel like the electorate was engaged for all of the reasons that have been discussed. But most importantly, I'm really excited about the possibility to have higher turnout amongst our military. And that has been a grave concern of mine for so long, and I am really, really looking forward to, not resolving that issue, but making significant strides as a state. And so I am supportive of this bill, and I thank you.
Thank you, Representative Pugh. Representative Scott, and I think we'll move on to a couple testifiers. Right.
Just a very short question. Why the third week in June versus the second week in June? Or
Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Scott. You know, part of it is to give more an extra week in there for coming right out of session and into the primary. That was part of it. And I'll just address, thank you so much for your comments, Representative Pugh, Representative Nash, Representative Nelson. And I think I will address some of your concerns. Both party chairs are willing to work and to really get a good schedule and work together with this. So, but that's really the main thing. It just gives us a little bit, one extra week there.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Representative Joaquim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fenton, Secretary of State Simon. The one concern I do have is just, and it's the only concern, frankly, and it's because I have college-age kids who had a hard time participating in the process because they're away at school. So I know we have a measure for caucuses where they can do a letter, but it makes it a lot harder with conventions. But if they do make it to that state level, if they take the time off from school to get back here and do a Senate district convention, and then they end up getting to be selected, lucky enough to select to be a delegate to go to the state convention, they're then also having to leave school to try to attend that. So that's the only concern I have, getting our younger people involved. I just want to throw that out there.
Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Joaquim. And I, too, have college-age kids, and my kids had to come back to vote absentee. And I will make one comment, though, that they are still here in June. So that's one avenue that will help. Is they'll at least, they will be able to participate in the June primary. But again, I think all sides are going to work together to really come for a really good schedule.
At this time, we'll move on to a couple testifiers I have on the list. Mr. Joe Mansky, if he's in the audience, and then Mr. Sulem will follow up. And if we can keep our comments brief and to the point, it'd be greatly appreciated for our time schedule. This committee greatly appreciates brevity and quality.
Mr. Chairman, I am Joe Mansky. I'm from the Ramsey County Elections Office, but I'm not speaking for Ramsey County today. I'm speaking on behalf of the County Auditors Association. And as Secretary Simon mentioned to you, as a group, we are opposed to the earlier primary date, and it's primarily because of the timing issue. That if this were a state election year, remember our tax bills go out on Monday. Our filing period, as Representative Nelson pointed out, would be 8 days later. We would start voting absentee on May 1st, and our property tax deadline is on May 15th. Many of our members are small. The last time I was in Traverse County, they had a two-person office that was the auditor and the deputy auditor, and they did everything. And the concern here is that there are just too many things going on, or would be going on, at the same time, and that with the September schedule, which I wish we could go back to, and perhaps with the better technology, we will be able to go back to that someday. But until then, having the sequential event of having the property tax activity coming first and then the election activity coming somewhat later, that makes the county staffing a lot easier, especially for those of our members who are not here in the metropolitan area and who do not have a specialized election organization as we do here in Ramsey County. And, Mr. Chairman, I'll just leave it at that and be happy to answer any of your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Mansky. Mr. Sulem.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sulem, General Counsel and Director of Governmental Relations for the Minnesota Association of Townships. We do not have a position on June versus August versus any other month other than The other body looked at a March date that was very problematic with our town elections held earlier this week. But what I wanted to raise was a consequence or an issue that we'll need to have some consideration and work on, and that is the training of election judges and election officials. We currently work with the counties to provide that as part of our summer, what we call our summer short courses, which are in June. We set that schedule specifically to accommodate the August primary. We moved away from July and moved it to June. We are unable to make additional changes to that, so what it will mean is an additional probably 500 election officials will need to go back strictly to the county for their training. I mean, that's what the law provides, but we worked out that they provide in conjunction with us. Either that, or if we could maybe look at having some options for alternative dates, we're willing to do that, but we couldn't do it by 2016 because we have to lock in our contracts and our speaking places beforehand. So should June move forward, I would also encourage that you consider delaying it to 2018 so we would have time to work with our county colleagues on efficient training for our officers.
Thank you, Mr. Sulem. Ms. Kelleher, do you wish to testify as well? Thank you. We appreciate brevity.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. And I know if you've been around enough, you've heard us get up when the primary date changes because we are concerned about getting members to run for the school board. And we find out the farther away that is from the election, people just aren't thinking about it at that time. So we've been challenged in outstate, especially finding folks who are ready to run for the school board, and we just want to share our ongoing concern that local officials are having a hard time. So any kind of publicity or information would definitely help hopefully find candidates in those areas. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Ms. Kelleher. Any other member questions? Sir, did you wish to testify? All right, come on down, sir. If you would, introduce yourself for the record and let us know who you represent.
Sure. Thanks, Chair and members. Andy Burns with the Libertarian Party of Minnesota. Obviously, I think sometimes things can be overlooked, and alternative parties don't always get maybe a fair shake in how this might impact. When you're trying to, for some reason, and it could be explained maybe to me, but the candidate petitioning period would be moved back 2 months, so this would put our petitioning to late March or early April. Now, compare that to now it's obviously May 20th. It was May 20th through June 3rd, so a lot easier, but if you're out in the cold and trying to collect signatures, it can be snowy, rainy, and cold. And basically, I mean, your number of signatures you can get, there's like no one out. You know, everyone's inside. So that barrier, I would say, should be considered. I don't know if you do move the June primary, why do we have to file so early as a, you know, third party? It should stay, you know, where it is, or at least not be moved back so far. So I guess that's my question, is why is it tethered to why is it tethered to the primary?
And it was a Mr. Burns.
Yep.
Thank you. I don't know if we have someone from the Secretary of State's office that wishes to comment on that. Thank you, Ms. Struther, for making yourself available.
Members of the committee, Julie Struther with the Minnesota Secretary of State's office. My understanding is the question was why the petition would be required, petition date, the filing date would be moved back. It is in part because we talked about the 46-day period that's required to send out military and overseas ballots. So in order to know, we need to know who's going to be on the ballot well in advance. So all of those timelines right now would need to be moved back, including the petition date that you're talking about is the nominating petition, which is the petition that is used to get on the ballot. So that would need to be correspondingly moved back.
I guess,
Mr. Burns.
So we're not on the primary ballots, so why would we? We can't be on the primary ballot as a. If you're petitioning for a candidate, you know, you're not on the primary ballot, so why does that affect that?
Ms. Strother.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe they could be on the primary ballot? And perhaps no. Okay, Joe is shaking his head. Joe is shaking his head. Someone else is nodding their head at me. I apologize. But that is the candidate filing period for all candidates. So that's all the information I think I can shed light on here.
Thank you, Ms. Strother.
The only thing I have is, need to do more research on it, but Anderson versus Celebriza, 1980, I believe, in Ohio, it was a case where they required, I think it was John Anderson, the president, to petition in March, and this would be doing the same thing. HF 1365 is making us petition in March, and they deemed that unconstitutional, so... sorry, I just wasn't briefed enough on this soon enough, but you can look into that.
Thank you, Mr. Burns. We'll take a look at that. It'll be interesting to see how other states do it again. If we moved here, I think, as the Secretary of State said, we'd be somewhere in the 30s. So, you know, most of the states have earlier primaries than we currently do, so it'll be interesting to see how those states handle those things. We'll take a look. Okay. Thank you for your testimony. I don't see any other member questions at this time. Anyone else wishing to testify briefly on this bill? Seeing none, Representative Fenton, we will give you the last words.
Thank you, and like Secretary Simon, I look forward to working to make sure this is a great bill, and thank you for your comments and questions, and I move that House File 1365 be referred to the General Register.
Representative Fenton moves that House File 1365 be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. House File 1365 is on its way to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Fenton. That the last bill on the agenda today is House File 1387 and Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Committee. I'll move House File 1387 be referred to Mr. Chairman. Where are we sending this?
Representative Nelson, we can lay it over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill if you want to do it that way.
We can do it that way, yep. And members, I was asked by the Secretary of State's office to carry this bill, and so that's why Ms. Struthers is here. She's going to explain the bill. But first off, we have a amendment,
the A1 amendment.
Yeah, okay, I'm looking perfect. At the Senate version of it that I had here, the A1 amendment.
They're always wrong.
Yeah. So I move the
Representative A1 Nelson moves the A1 to your amendment, Representative Nelson.
It's just changing the date from January...
Ms. Strother.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, what it does is it makes it clear that it's a one-year period to collect signatures. The bill is originally drafted, set a January 1st date, and this just clarifies that it's a full year to collect signatures.
All in favor of the author's amendment to put the bill in the shape that he wishes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Nelson, to your bill as amended.
And I will let Ms. Struthers describe the bill and what it does.
Ms. Strother?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what this bill does is it essentially fills an area where there's silence in Minnesota law, and the Secretary of State's office reached out to Representative Nelson to help us provide clarity. We've gotten questions from political parties about when, if they wanted to petition to become a major or minor party, they could start collecting signatures, and right now there's nothing in statute that says when that is, so we were unable to provide guidance. To be clear, this is about petitioning to be a major or minor party and not ballot access. There's ballot access through the nominating petitions, which is what we were discussing just a few minutes ago. But this is about achieving major or minor party status. In Minnesota, to achieve major or minor party status, there's two ways to achieve status. One is through the ballot, and that's either receiving 1% for minor party status or 5% for major party status of the votes at the general election. The other way that we have in Minnesota law to achieve that status is through a petition, where you need to achieve the equivalent of 1% or 5% in petition signatures of the number of voters in the last general election. And so we have in statute very clearly the number of signatures that need to be gathered, and that's not being changed by this bill. But this bill would just make clear when you can start collecting them. I will say that since this law passed, since we allowed people to petition to become a major or minor party, the Secretary of State's office has not received a petition to be a major or minor party. So although this is not a problem we've encountered yet, we have had questions from parties about when they want to when they can collect signatures, and we haven't been able to provide an answer. There's been some various interpretations in our office, but you know, some are as short as 2 weeks if it's considered a nominating petition for the minor party, and there's some case law that says it could be as far back as the caucus state, but there's no statutory guidance. I will say that there are some real benefits of a one-year period. It's a clear period for collecting signatures. It allows the parties the flexibility to determine when they want to start collecting signatures. We looked at where other states were at for the time period that they allowed for collecting signatures, though they have different signature thresholds. And, for example, Wisconsin sets a January 1st date for the year the petition is due, and so that's essentially like a six-month period for their filing period. Actually, it might be shorter than that because their primary is earlier. But what we feel is the one-year period provides clear guidance, balances the need to give the parties time if they want to try this avenue, but also against sort of the concern that the courts have expressed about the staleness of signatures, you know, making sure that they properly reflect the person's intent at the time they signed. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions, but again, I appreciate the legislature weighing in and providing some clarity where there's right now just silence.
Thank you, Ms. Strother. Any member questions or comments? So you guys did a great job introducing your bill. Anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against the bill?
I think Mr. Burns wants to speak on this bill. You
can stay up here. Welcome back to the committee, Mr. Burns. If you would just, again, introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you. Chair and members of the committee, Andy Burns, Libertarian Party of Minnesota Executive Director. Like she was saying, this provision was passed in 1913. Obviously, the 5%, it's so difficult, no one's even attempted, to my knowledge, to even go out and do this. You're basically, it was actually 10% before that, and they went down to 5%, but that was back in 1899. The only states with the petition, I guess we have to look at, you're changing the time period, but at the same time, you know, mentioning Wisconsin's 10,000 signatures. Well, or it's maybe at the start of the year, you said? Well, it's only 10,000 signatures for them. For us, it's 120,000. And how you get to that math is, last general election, if you're looking at a midterm, it'd be 120,000 signatures, or 100,000 signatures, but not all signatures are valid, right? So you got to build in a buffer. 20% is kind of what we do, just because you never know. You got to be safe, so that's where we mark it. Midterm election, 120,000 we're looking at. Presidential election, 175,000. You're looking at levels that are totally unheard of, so I guess you should consider amendment to actually reduce that level to something more reasonable and in line with other states around us. The only other states that are more difficult than us are Oklahoma and Maine at 5% and California at 10%. So that's kind of where I think you guys should take this conversation. If you're actually addressing this, which no one's ever tried this method, it's kind of like looking for a problem or a solution where there's no problem, because you will not be having anyone attempt this method, because I already did the research. It's 30,000 signatures per month, and that's like 200 per hour for every day for till 2016. It's not going to happen. And we don't have the money to pay people every day. You know, it's just, so... with that said, I would say that when you have that midterm and general election problem, you get, so I said 120,000 or 175,000. You got a huge discrepancy there. You should actually have a flat cap on the signatures. It's just a seesaw effect. It can range, you know, 55,000 difference in if we decide to do it after a general midterm or a presidential election. So I would argue, look at the other states. We came up with 25,000 as a reasonable figure for major party status and 5,000 for minor party status. Most minor parties will never try to get do it through 5,000 signatures. They will just put up a candidate and they'll get 1%. We have now have five major or minor parties within Minnesota, so that really doesn't really pertain, but just to keep the law consistent with the levels of those are the thresholds I would say, 25,000 and 5,000. The only last part I have is this actual case is resolution would be unconstitutional. If you look at McLean versus Meyer, 1980, it was in North Dakota. They found that gathering 15,000 signatures, it was struck down because it was so difficult. And they had a deadline or a start date of June 1st of the previous year, which is pretty much the same thing we're trying to do here. So it might be a week earlier or 2 weeks earlier for us here. And that was at 3.3%, that 15,000. So you're looking at if 3.3% there was unconstitutional, we're at 5%. I mean, we're just talking that we're all out of whack, but I understand that alternative parties, we're not here, you know, we don't have any representation. So that's kind of our issue. If you're looking at 3.3, it would be still 59,000 signatures. So we should just put it in line with other states. So my proposal would be 25,000 for major party status. And that's where I'm at for now.
Thank you, Mr. Burns. Appreciate your testimony, Representative Nelson.
And I just want to comment to what he said. It's 5% for major party, which right now the two major parties are the Democrats and the Republicans. For minor party status to get on the ballot, it's 1%.
And that's to get minor party status. They can get on the ballot.
Yeah, but for minor, but that's what I'm saying. For minor party status, with the last election, we had just under 2 million voters. So it would be, it's 1% of that would be 19,925. If you add 20%, as he was saying, on to add on top of that, you're talking 22,000 votes. This actually, to get minor party status, is actually lower than the 25,000 he's talking about. So it is. Like I said, and by making a definite time period on it, it tells people when they can start getting the signatures and gives them a definite ending date, beginning and ending date.
Thank you, Representative Nelson.
Thank you.
Any other member questions or comments on the bill? Seeing none, Representative Nelson, we will give you the final word.
Good bill, vote
yes. We're going to allow one more testifier. Sir, we have about 2 minutes left in the committee, so if you would please be brief, but go ahead and state your name for the record and who you represent.
Yes, I'll be very brief. My name is Mike Harrison. I'm a registered lobbyist. I don't lobby for any particular group. I am a libertarian myself. And in 1972, my mother ran for state senate, which began my career in politics at about 9 years old. So I've been doing this for quite some time. The one thing that I will say and be done is that I believe that this bill, very supportive, will allow people like my parties to be involved in the process. And I think that's a good thing when we do that. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Harrison. Appreciate your testimony.
As I said, just good bill, vote yes.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Nelson renews his motion that House File 1387, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion or further action. With that, the bill is laid over. Thank you, Representative Nelson.
You.
With that, the meeting is adjourned.